other's point of view, but I see a lot of, you know, people who say, you know, in this codependency, you know, that this over-caring, he doesn't have time to do his chores around the house because he has to be on the swim team.
Right.
She's taking gymnastics. She really doesn't have time to do her clothes. And so they release the children from very, very valuable building things for their, and let them get involved in, you know, instead of having the kid earn gymnastics or earn piano lessons, they say, oh, she doesn't have really time to do the dishes.
This is true.
And that's a form, to me, of codependency, too, where you release,
where
you treat people perennially as irresponsible and as more childlike than they need to be.
You are enabling, in your words, irresponsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And that's hard. It's easy for us to sit around this morning and talk about that, and you get into the actual setting, and it's hard to get off. Because you are seduced. You are seduced into saying, well, I really don't want to rock the boat. Or it isn't that big of a deal. Well, maybe one isn't that big of a deal, but 10,000 times the one is a big deal. And then further on down the road, we scratch our heads and we say, how did all this come about anyway? How on earth did this happen? Yes?
The other side of that too is when there's a dual working family, everybody has to pitch in.
Yeah.
And I have felt sometimes guilt over the amount of work that our children do. You know, maybe I should be doing more. I'm working at it. It's real, you know. It's easy, but I felt that at the beginning that, well, they're loading logs, they're doing the dishes, they're shoveling the sidewalk, they're doing the grass. But it is a gift that we do for each other and living as a community family and all participating.
Yeah.
But some moms go through the guilt of not allowing their children, oh, I better do this, I better do that. Some parents go through the other side of, oh, goodness, you know, I should be doing more.
I have some put together now some suggestions about how we can, if indeed we want to do it, how we can bring these streams together. And I tell you very sincerely that sometimes, maybe more often than not, we do in fact need professional help simply because of our blindness, simply because of our of the strength of denial, of the power of denial. My gosh, I could just pull one story out and tell you about a colleague who was an adolescent chemical dependency counselor working in a setting for years and years and years, had two addicted kids in their household and never saw it. Never saw it. It took the high school counselor to call him from his job at the CD treatment center, out to the school, and confront. So the power of denial is so strong. And we really don't want to see reality. We'd much rather pull the wool over our eyes. We would. We really would. When we're really honest with ourselves, we would much rather see things the way we want them to be rather than the way they are. And that's why I say, before I even mention how we can go about bringing these together, it's so difficult that sometimes you do need somebody. Sometimes you do need a professional really to help you to see this. First of all, distinguish between caring that is appropriate and caring that is over-caring or overbearing. Loving other people is a natural extension of our loving ourselves. You know that's the way it works. God loves me. That's a given. I must in turn love God. That is the basic foundational commandment of the whole Bible, of all of Christianity. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. That allows me to love Bill. To say, Bill, you're okay. You count. You have been gifted with a lot of talents and abilities, and you've chosen to use them. That then allows me to love you and to accept you as I love and accept myself. Now, if I don't manage to get these first two off, ain't no way I'm going to manage to get the third one off. Namely, if I may love God, and I know God loves me, but I can't stand myself, I say I'm a zero, there is no way I'm going to love and accept you people. I can go through the motions, I can talk about it, but it's not going to be authentic. Furthermore, you are going to have one heck of a time loving me, because I'm going to continually be giving off messages saying, you don't want to love me. No, you don't want to love me. I'm a zero. You don't want to invest yourself in me. No, 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 no. Now see how all this figures into the caring, the serving, the self-serving, and the over-caring. Loving others is a natural extension of loving ourselves. You will feel good about it, and so will the other person. In all caring situations that are authentic and valid and healthy, you will feel good about what you are doing, and so will the other person. There will be positive things that are happening, but you have to be honest. You can't kid yourself. You can't pretend and say, oh yes, there are good things happening. I mean, my husband is continuing to keep his job because I cover for him over his when he's out flat working off a hangover. I cover for him. When we can't make it to the party, I say, oh, Joe's really under the weather tonight and we can't make it. That's not helpful, you see. Good things will happen out of the caring. If good things aren't happening, then it's not honest. Then it's not caring. It's actually harming. But I say it's so difficult not to pull the wool over our eyes. When this is not happening, whenever I'm not liking the caring and the person who's receiving it isn't liking it, something is not right. Something is wrong, and the caring probably is not healthy. Secondly, in distinguishing between healthy and unhealthy caring, see if there is any resentment underneath the caring. See if the sacrifice gives me a good feeling, or if, on the other hand, I have a real edge of resentment about it. Have you ever been conned into helping somebody that you didn't realize you were being conned until sometime after the fact? And then you kept up the helping, you kept up doing it, but it did not feel right. It just did not feel right. And then as the time went on, you began to get a real edge of resentment, and you actually started to truly dislike a person. And then you're stuck, then you're caught. You don't know how to get out of it. That's the unhealthy caring. And Lord knows there are just tons of cons walking around. People who make their living, who live their lives, conning other people into doing all sorts of nice things for them. And being charitable Christian people that we are, we say, yes, of course, I will help you. I will drive you to the supermarket every Thursday since your husband died so you can do your shopping. And then after about 3 months of it, I begin to realize there's absolutely no reason why this woman can't drive herself. She can drive the car. And so I don't want to do it anymore. And I feel like I'm being used. I'm being abused. But how am I going to get out from under? Am I caught? Am I stuck? Oftentimes, people in a dependent relationship may very well realize it, but how am I going to get out of it? How am I going to get out of this mess that I am in? And so the second suggestion that I have for you in trying to determine one from the other, the healthy from the unhealthy, is see if there's any resentment there. There should not be in loving and caring any resentment, children. Thirdly, see if there are any unrealistic expectations. Any of you who do premarital counseling, premarriage counseling, may, as I oftentimes do, run into well-meaning individuals. There's always only one, not necessarily two. If there are two, both the man and the woman, then it probably is something we can work on. But usually it's only one who will firmly believe that marriage is some kind of a magic. And this, regardless of whether the people have been arm's length from each other for 3 years or whether they've been living together for 3 years, makes no difference. somehow there still is this fantasy that marriage will work a miracle and he will change. She will be different after we're married. I will love her so much. I will do so much for her. I will do myself in for him. And that will effect the change. That will make the transformation. That will let the butterfly fly out of the caterpillar. Uh-uh. See if there are unrealistic expectations in the caring that you are giving. And that's another trap that we just get sucked into. There's a real drain I did pots this morning up on dish team this morning. And whenever the big stainless steel sinks, when the water goes out of them, and you get right down to the bottom, it really goes right down. And that's the way we get this pulled right into this. Especially those of us who are tender and caring people by nature and by education and by experience. Particularly those of us of a strong Christian orientation. Tremendous temptation to have unrealistic expectations of what our caring will or will not accomplish. Four, see if there is a fear of risking change in the relationship, whether it's the caregiving, whether it's healthy care or unhealthy care. See if there is a risk. I'm sorry. See if there's a fear in risking change. I'm going to continue to give this care, over care, because I'm afraid of taking the risk of getting out of whatever it is, oftentimes a relationship. And I know that many people will say in a critical way, that's all well and good, Bill. But you know, sometimes getting out of a mess is easier said than done. And all I can say is, I feel with you. There's no question about it. That it is indeed a great risk, but which is worse or which is better? Shall we stay in the misery and continue to ruin our own lives as well as the life of another person or other persons? Or shall we take the risk of somehow moving out of that? Secondly, when we're talking about how we can bring these together, know that love can be tough as well as tender. And that also sounds good. And that's another thing that came out of the whole AA movement, for which we must everlastingly be grateful. We really have, I'm not particularly on an AA kick, but I'm telling you, there's an awful lot of very positive insight that has come out of that whole movement in the few short years it's been around, actually. To realize that caring can be tough. When you're talking about the whole process of rearing kids, of saying, we shall establish limits. Not to be mean, not to be arbitrary, but we know that beyond certain limits, trouble lies, and therefore, even though we may not be able to see it, we know it's there, and therefore limits are established. We do ourselves and another person whom we're overcaring no good at all by denying the truth that love can be tough as well as tender. That I can say to a person who is abusing me by his or her addiction or whatever the problem is, I love you so much that I will no longer allow you to sin against me, nor will I any longer participate in your sin. Oh, that's easy to sit here and say, but I'll tell you, it's something else to get off. And that's why I say it. I make no bones about it. It's tough. But it's a matter of choice, a matter of decision. Shall we challenge the situation? Or shall we go on continually like this? Covering for, avoiding, denying, pretending, pulling wool over our eyes. try to decide, what we do is we try to decide if the caring is helping the cared for one to more completeness and more wholeness, to this perisos, this abundant life. And if that isn't happening, there's something wrong. Caring needs to move in that direction for it to be authentic and to be valid.
I tell people that love is not rescuing. And so that if your kid loses their mitten, then they have to go through the cold hands. Because if you give them another mitten, then they'll never become responsible for their own hands. And that's a real tough, you know, that's real tough for parents to do, is to not pack their kid's lunch and to say, well, if he forgot his lunch, he goes hungry. Well, kids haven't died of malnutrition over one at lunch hour. But that's a real tough one for parents to, even schools. Forget their lunch, they give them their own, then they provide the kids lunch, instead of making the child go through that process of maturing enough to take care of themselves enough to take care of themselves.
Well, we can't have starving children, and we can't have frostbitten hands, you know how it is.
Yeah. Someone
told me,
rescuing aspect.
Yeah, and the rescuing. Someone told me last week of a problem with her daughter, of never wanting to get out of bed in the morning to go to school, and how impossible it was. Until one day, she just said, I'm going to call you at the appropriate time and make sure that you are awake, and from there on, kid, it's up to you. Well, nothing changed, and the kid was late and late. She had to take a note in, finally, I don't know, after three times or whatever the rule was in her school. So she asked her mother for a note. So her mother said, I'll give you a note. So her mother wrote on the note, Susie will be late, has been late for school these days, because she wanted to stay in bed rather than get up and go to school. And in her, this surprised me, but she said in that school system, the teacher read the note to the whole class. And I thought that would be pretty rough, you know, but the way it was, the kids just razzed her enough. It wasn't something that really damaged her. But it certainly did turn her around. And all the way through until, wasn't it real, until she was out of high school? Then she got into a habit in college with a roommate who was of the same ilk and fell back into her trap. But all through high school, it worked. Her mother decided to stop rescuing her and say, kid, you're on your own.
Yeah. Oh, where do you draw the line?
Where do you draw the line? Right?
What's going to be damage producing and what's going to be respectful?
Yeah.
Encouraging.
Right.
That's where you have to understand where what you were talking about earlier is realistic expectations. Mm-hmm. You have to have an understanding of what the kids can really, you know, or anybody, you know, anybody you're in relationship with has to have, you have to have a realistic expectation of what they're capable of.
Ah, but what if you're dysfunctional and you don't know yourself?
That's why you need professional help. Oh, wait, let me come back to that, though. I'm serious. That's why I say very often you need professional help to sit down with all the parties involved and see what the dynamics are so you can sort them out. Sometimes they get so badly twisted around, you don't know who's enabling whom. Yes,
no. I was one of these that didn't do the say no, right? And I would take the lunch, you know, just like things like that. And so when it got to college level and we're talking about money for a course, and he didn't turn in his assignment in time because he hadn't learned this discipline of his own responsibility, then the money was involved. It cost him, he had to go another semester or another course.
And he was paying for it.
And I had to pay for it. I mean, well, he didn't have any income to do it, and I wanted to graduate. But had I let what I said to other people learn from my experience, because they failed when they're little, like because it cost me a bunch when he got to college.
Yeah. Notice something. I don't mean to pick on you, but what you said, what you said is just a classic, though. I had to so-and-so.
That's right. Yeah,
I had to bring the lunch. I had to get him up. I had to so-and-so.
I am a rescuer. Yeah. I'm a nurse by profession. And
well, you're one of them, huh?
I fit right into that.
Okay. Yes.
I think that it might be helpful for you to... clarify how people can select good professional counselors, because there are counselors out there, and there are counselors out there. In fact, I know one in particular who has, well, let me back up. Different states have different requirements as far as being a professional counselor. And I know one woman who has read this book, Women Who Care Too Much. And she has hung out her shingle, and she calls herself a counselor. And the woman has a personality disorder. And she, no, I kid you not. And she is helping other people.
Okay, I have two leads for you to answer your question very specifically. Two organizations that you can consult with to determine capable counselors. One, essentially, people of a spiritual orientation. That would be the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, the AAPC. And the other one would be, all those people are certified by that organization. The other one is the AAMFT, the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists. And their certifying requirements are as much as or more than the state's requirements for licensing. Our state of Minnesota just last year began to require licensing of us who do marriage and family therapy. And when we submitted our credentials and our training and experience to the state, if we qualified to be licensed by the state, we automatically, became eligible for membership and clinical members in the AAMFT. So those two organizations, the AAPC is domiciled in Washington, D.C., and so is the AAMFT. Is that right? They're both in Washington, D.C. on like G Street or I forget. But anyway, it's easy to find out. I know what you're saying. This is very true. I should say something else to you. This is off the cuff. But do not feel obligated to a counselor if you do not connect. Now, I take a risk saying that because your first encounter with a counselor may be where a counselor sees something that she or he needs to confront you with, and you say, I don't need that crap, and you pull out. But I do mean to say that I believe more people err in the direction of feeling obligated to stay in a counseling relationship with a person with whom they don't feel good. That's not true. That's not at all true. You are the person calling the shots in terms of the relationship. If you don't feel comfortable in that relationship, you have every right to say to the person, thank you for our encounters up to this point. I feel a need to go somewhere else. Goodbye.
Another issue is the insurance issue.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a really big issue.
You can get stuck on that one, right, where you don't have any choice, unless you pay out of your own pocket, of course. But again, you always have a choice, like I've said. Yes?
I just had a question. What qualifications? Must these people go into counseling themselves prior to the certification?
Generally, a part of the requirements, I think if I remember rightly, the requirements for our state licensure were 1,000 hours of supervised counseling.
No, but personal counseling.
Yeah, and I'm saying that while there isn't anything explicit that I can remember in the requirements, nobody gets through it without being in therapy himself or herself.
Yeah, that's because where that would cover for a person like that.
But not always.
But you need to never hesitate to ask a person for his or her credentials. You don't have to be shy about that. If there isn't stuff hanging on the wall that has a state licensure or a board licensure on it, ask to see it. You don't have to be shy about that at all. If a person mumbles and jumbles about it, say, well, thanks, but no thanks. Like the person who read Robin's book and then hung a shingle out. Yeah.
I think you also ought to remember that one counselor might be good for somebody, but not good for you.
That's right.
And that happens a lot. And also, I don't know about other states, but in California, any pastor, and this was about 20 years ago now, or 15 years ago now, any pastor could get a license because they grandfathered them in.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of wait for a few funerals before you get qualified counselors. Not that all pastors aren't, but
that's
there are a lot
right.
of pastors who aren't qualified even though they have a certificate on the wall.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point that Wendell's making too, that I was alluding to a little earlier, that don't pull back simply because maybe you're seeing something that you don't want to see in yourself or in your relationships. The third element I have here in my list of how we can bring these opposites or extremes together says, abandon the need to control others. Don't confuse, or try not to confuse, caring with controlling. This is especially the case in rearing kids. We have to do a lot of letting go. The chart in that whole process of who's in control goes kind of like this. You start out where this is the amount of control from 0 to 100%. And this is time, as time moves on. When you start out at the birth of a child, you're at 100 to 0. I mean, parents have 100% responsibility for the kid, and the kid has none whatsoever. And that's the way it has to be. And as time goes on, now, this is going to be a different line for different kids, simply because children, given their own unique individuality, develop into maturity at different rates. But essentially what we have to realize, and we must realize, is that the amount of parental control decreases as time goes on, and the amount of kid responsibility or kid control increases as time goes on. And many times we get caught up in hanging on to statements that were valid in those early years. Well, I know better. I know best. I don't want to see him or her get hurt. That's valid, but we have to let that go little by little as time goes on, as kids mature in years, and hopefully in the skills of living their lives. But don't confuse caring with controlling. I confused caring with controlling with my stepmother and struggled with that woman for years to try to help her with her faulty thinking about bigotry. The woman was an absolute bigot. She was not prejudiced, she was bigoted. She had no love for black people and no love for Roman Catholics. And I was going to convert this dear soul. Talked to my wife Marilyn sometime about our knockdown, drag-out battles where she, Marilyn, would just get up and leave and say, I can't stand this, this is too much. Until one day, and if I knew how this happened, I would patent it, copyright it, and I would make $1 billion on it. It dawned on me, I'm trying to control this woman's life and I can't do it. I can't change her. I don't have the power to do it. And I sat at my desk in my office at Fairview Hospital on Riverside Avenue and laughed and laughed. I did. I just laughed and laughed. And I couldn't wait for us to get back to Pittsburgh and for me to encounter her and say, looky here. I always called her Auntie. It's over, kid. It ain't going to be no more. If you want to tangle hind ends, you're going to have to do it with yourself. It's not because we're Germans, you know, and you sit down at the table and you just hammer away at each other. And I said, I'm going to accept you as you are in your bigotry.
How noble!
How noble!
I did.
But take the risk of letting go. I don't know, when you're asking, where is the line of propriety? Where where do you abandon responsibility? It's a very tight rope to walk, and we do make mistakes. Sometimes we hang on longer than we should have. We should let them go. Sometimes we let them go too soon and they get hurt, and we say, well, why didn't I hold on no longer?
Or they please grow up and be good despite of you.
Right. Please try to accept that as a part of our sinful human imperfection. We are not going to bat a thousand. We'll do our best and pray God to help us where we fail. Abandon the need to control in marriage relationship, that my caring, my loving, my sacrificing will make him or her change. Leaders have to do that. We have to do it in leadership roles too. I cannot do it all. I don't have that much power, that much strength. I simply cannot do it all. And if I don't risk letting go some of the responsibility, I will indeed burn out. But as I said last week, the only people who burn out are people who want to burn out. If you don't want to burn out, you will never burn out. You will choose not to be involved in that kind of behavior that will burn you out. And then somebody says to me, and I always used to get this from the intensive care nurses or the coronary care nurses, you don't understand, Bill, you just don't understand. They say, you got to work a double shift back to back. And I say, how do you shape your mouth to say no? Oh, are you out to lunch? You can't say no. Try it. Take the risk of trying it. Recognize that you are not the Messiah, Jesus.
Under the course title of Finding Balance in a World of Extremes. And today, dealing with the subject of caring, where caring in our experience of life comes to rest on the spectrum, the continuum. For you who may be joining us for the first time today, what we've been doing is looking at various aspects or dimensions or facets of the life experience and perceiving them to have extremes. And we're looking at each of the extremes, which present themselves at different ends of the continuum, and trying to find a way to bring them together for a sense of balance, basing that on the premise that when Jesus said to us he came that we might have life more abundantly, that word in the Greek, perissos, means super added, just overflowing. And whenever he said, be perfect or be teleos, as your Father in heaven is teleos, it meant to be whole and complete. This is the experience of life that Jesus has in mind for us. And my contention is that we find that only by managing somehow in our own lives to bring these opposites together and find a sense of balance. We don't realize that we live close to or in an extreme in much of our lives until something happens that awakens us to that fact. A catastrophe or an intervention or a real tragedy. And then people are heard to say, I can't believe that my life has been so lopsided. I never realized it. The aberration became the norm. The unusual became the usual. And I know that we, all of us, I included, want to say, no, I'm a very moderate person. I don't live in the extremes. But more often than not, whenever I put my mind to it and look at these things, I say, not so, Bill. Not so. This, again, is, and I'm remembering to do it, this is a Discuss As We Go course. Hey, how about that? That's the first time in 8 sessions. I did it. I looked down and I wrote it in red ink this time, see? This is a Discuss As We Go course, which means that whenever you have some observation or question or criticism or story to tell or whatever, you have to come right in, because we won't hold off for 20 minutes or so at the end in order to have that free-for-all. So please do, feel free, very seriously, feel free to make your comments, ask your questions as we go along. some of these things that, and this is also obviously very arbitrary, but some of the things that come to mind as I look at the extremes and as I have seen them manifested in people over the years, on the self-sacrifice end. Now remember again, this is a caricature. This is the extreme, the ultimate. These are people who fall into the Messiah complex, and I'll talk with you about that in a little bit. People who fall into codependency and enabling, and we'll talk about that. People who get into the twisted tree syndrome. You know what the twisted tree syndrome is? That's something I haven't seen here. This is our first experience hiking around the Cascades. I haven't seen what we see very frequently in the Rockies, where a tree will grow up around a rock. It'll want to go up straight, but the rock is in the way, and so the tree will kind of circle around it. If this is the way the tree is going to come up, and there's a rock in the hillside, it'll go around the tree, and then go around the rock, and then go on up like that. And then in time, water or wind or erosion will knock the rock away. And as you're going by on a trail, you look at these things, and this is what you see. You see this crazy tree that grows kind of like this out of the ground. Well, it strikes me that that is the way a lot of the self-sacrificers develop. They develop their lives around some object. Maybe a drunken spouse, maybe an abusive father, maybe a workaholic mother or what. It doesn't matter what the object is, what the rock was. And they are, and oftentimes in counseling or in therapy, able to look back and see how they have literally shaped their whole experience of life up to this point around that person or around that issue. So that their life has never really been their own. They've lived it out. They have literally sacrificed their own personhood for the sake of the rock, whatever the rock was. Mother, father, spouse, some problem, some issue in the family or whatever. That's the twisted tree syndrome. And another dimension, of course, is the people-pleasing dimension of self-sacrifice. I will do myself in for you. And we'll talk more about that. Now we run down to the other end of the spectrum and we get into the self-service end and come upon what this generation has been branded as the me generation, looking out for me. Couldn't care less society. Just couldn't care less. I had absolutely no interest in you, 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 or you. What's in it for me? Ah, that's the biggie. What's in it for me? Bill, would you mind doing so-and-so? Well, I don't know. What's in it for me? And the people discounting, really no regard for other people. That's one of the frightening things, one of the very, very frightening things of our culture. We were talking last week, I think, about the growing disregard, especially among drug users, the growing disregard for people. I mean, it's frightening, absolutely frightening. So that now, any of you from New York City? Anybody from Manhattan? Most of the people, the old salts of Manhattan now, will no longer confront anybody who abuses them on the walk. You know, you used to be able, somebody come up and bang into you, push them aside, because that's the way you relate in New York, in New York City, on the streets of New York City. Now, because of the danger of the person being high and literally out of his or her gourd, people will just kind of get around and move right on. Total disregard for other people. It's an extreme, I know, but nevertheless, that's what we're talking about. Let's settle down on the self-service side for just a minute to begin with. There's often, in this extreme, a relentless compulsion to promote number one. People will sacrifice family. They will sacrifice personal relationships. They will literally do anything at all to promote number one at the expense of whomever and whatever.
I've been pulling out stories from my career to illustrate some of these things, and the one I think of here was one time in our intensive care unit at the hospital where I used to work, where an elderly gentleman was dying, and his two of his sons were there, brothers, in the cubicle, as their father was just slowly slipping away, standing at the foot of the bed, ready to get into a physical battle over who was going to get what when the old man finally died. Right there in the intensive care unit. So the head nurse said to me, "Bill, will you see if you can get these guys out of here? I mean, it's crazy." And when I walked into the cubicle there, they were ready to go at each other, literally. That's an extreme, I know. But that's also true. It's easy to spot this side. I don't think we have any trouble with spotting these folk. Here's one right here. I brought these book covers along. I didn't bring the books. But we can pin these up like this. Away they go. Are you familiar with Winning Through Intimidation? Ringer, do you remember that one? And then he made such a killing on that because everybody said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, win through intimidation." Then he wrote this second one called Looking Out for Number One. And then Robin Norwood put this book together, which is also over in the bookstore, by the way. It's a very good book titled Women Who Love Too Much, but she was writing for women. There are also men who love too much, indicating this whole dimension of I will do myself in for you. I will do anything for you. And there are some dynamics behind that that we'll take a look at also later on this morning.
May I throw out that I think part of the self-service aspect I see a lot coming out from TV too. Kids who particularly watch an enormous amount of TV.
Yeah.
That they don't learn to relate to people. They don't learn to relate to their brothers and sisters. They don't learn to relate to their parents. They're relating to this inanimate object, and they don't see a world outside of themselves.
The forum last night with the teenagers was interesting. They refute what you're saying. However,
I keep mine locked.
However, they do point up that the younger kids do exactly what you're saying. And if you are a younger kid growing up in that, then when you're a teenager, you're still in it. I think what they were trying to say to us last night was that we at age 17, 18, weren't into that as little kids, and so we're not affected. However, the little kids are, and when they get to be teenagers, they're going to be in the same boat.
Because if you're watching TV instead of sitting down for a meal together, or if there's a TV as the third or tenth or whatever person at the table, you're not talking to each other, and you don't develop a caring relationship. Where it has to start, is with the family.
One of the things that we run into as spiritually minded people or religious people is that we have to be very careful in this dimension or this facet of life. Very, very careful, because Christianity is built on the foundation of loving service one of another. And so to hear me sit here as an ordained clergy person say, watch out for self-sacrifice and maybe give a little bit more thought to self-service, might just fly in the face of a lot of theological positions. But I mean it very sincerely. Pathology can very easily creep into the call for and the giving of service so that it becomes unhealthy and undesirable, and actually, if you want to speak to it in theological terms, becomes a sin within itself. I believe that it is a sin to contribute to the delinquency of any minor. And I believe, therefore, then that it is a sin to contribute to the addiction, whatever shape or form it takes, of any person that you have dealings with. Yes?
Well,
I've just seen this experience with people coming into our overseas church, and they want to get involved, they need to connect with us and so forth. So they jump right in and volunteer for this and volunteer for that. And me being one of the older ones there, I have to help, in a sense, encourage them to slow down, because I see the burnout. I've been there long enough to see, and that's the last thing we want.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to ask somebody because you know they'll say yes.
Do you know, do you believe, would you be willing to affirm that one can be addicted to church work? Oh, good, good.
Ask any church secretary. There's someone in their congregation who hangs around all the time and gets way more than they help.
It ain't just booze and drugs, right? Absolutely. Of course, we'll talk about a little later on what an addiction is or what a dependency is. And we really do have to spread our understanding of that to understand some of the dynamics in this particular facet or dimension of living. Why do people get into this extreme of self-service? And I thought, well, there must be several reasons. Some of us are just into egomaniacal self-preservation.
Say that 10 times.
Say that one again, yeah. That we never, some of us never grow out of that concept that we have in infancy that I've mentioned a couple times already in the series, that we are indeed the center of the universe, which we have to live out as infants in order to get our needs met and our wants fulfilled. Just look at these little bitty kids, how they control the world around here. They do. They literally control. And that's the way it's got to be. If you weren't that way and you didn't control the world at 2 a.m. in the morning, you'd starve. Probably. But the point is that in the process of becoming civilized, sophisticated, acculturated, or whatever, you realize that that's not true. That is no longer true at a certain point in life, and you begin to lay that aside. Unfortunately, some people don't. And for some people, it is actually fed because of self-sacrificing parents who will not intervene, who will not lock their kid in the closet or chain him to the wall. No, no, no. No, we were talking about drowning and so on like that before you all came in. I shouldn't even mention that because somebody will say, hey, Miller's talking about abusing kids today. No, no, no. I think a second reason for that, and let me, before I leave that, say that Lord knows there are just tons and tons of people around who fit that very well, who never lay aside that they won't say they're the center of the universe, of course, but they'll behave that way. I think a second reason why people get into this extreme is just blatant greed and avarice. That somehow in the process of developing and growing up, a person gets the idea that it's kind of nice to have things, and by golly, the way you get them is to maybe push other people out of the way to get them. And it seems to work. And if you can come on like gangbusters, you can do a lot of pushing aside and getting in and getting the goodies. And it turns out that greed and avarice is a driving force, literally, in our culture and society. I'm not going to say it. I was going to get into something that probably would get us up the wall and across the ceiling down the other side, so I won't do it.
Oh, come on.
No! We'll talk to me later. I'll talk to you later.
Don't be so self-serving here.
All right. Then there's another thing called existential anxiety, which is plain and simply realizing that being alive today is pretty risky. Of all the things that can happen. We used to fret about, well, maybe the Russians are going to nuke us. Well, it looks like maybe they won't now, but who knows how many smaller nations who may not have the same kind of self-control as a larger nation has. Who can say? You're going to say, come on, Bill, don't talk like that. That's the reality of life. We're here in our setting concerned this summer on the ecological systems that are just being raped and adulterated, and the mess that we are in there. And so consequently, we kind of go back to, do you remember a Studs Lonergan novel back in the 50s? Studs Lonergan's theme was live fast, die young, and have a good-looking corpse. Well, you can't much beat that one, can you? Say the people that are over at this end, live fast, get as much well. Look at the, who is it? Who has the, get all the gusto you can? Is that Schlitz or Bud? Or, you want to go around once, grab all the gusto you can? Which beer is that? Must be Schlitz. Anyway, there. I mean, it's right there selling beer. Live fast and look out for yourself and let the other person look out for herself and himself. I think also another dimension, another reason for this extreme is the growing depersonalization of our society, the lowering of the trust level. Just like I can remember as a younger man just walking the streets of New York and having no concerns at all. And then as time went on, realizing that the way you walk the streets of New York is like this. And you don't make too much eye contact. And now, as I'm telling you, it seems to be even more severe than that. That you don't, that if you happen to brush someone, you just gotta get away from them. Lowering of the trust level and heightening of suspicion. We are looking around and that way. I think that that dimension of the way our culture has developed also heightens this self-serving, looking out for number one. And also the instability, just the basic instability of our society. The instability of the family, of marriage, with divorce, the mobility of us, that we may live 10 different places or 20 different places in a lifetime, whereas two generations ago, people only lived maybe two places. Marilyn's mother, who's now 98, has only lived in two houses in her whole life. Well, actually, she's in a nursing home now, so that's the third one. But before she went into that, it was just the homestead, the farmstead on which she was, where she was born, and then the house that she and her husband, my father-in-law, built and lived until he died there, right in the house, and she came to Minnesota. All of that makes for a very fragile kind of environment wherein people say, I don't trust, you don't look right to me. You really don't look right to me. I don't trust you, and I don't know about you either. And look out, I'm gonna go for it myself. But how about the other? Well, let me pause and see. Yeah, Wendell?
Well, also the self-help books that we are so flooding the market, more used to 5 years ago than now maybe, but you know, pulling your own strings and all those are so self-centered that it's just kind of the milieu in which we live and have our being, which is self-serving all the way.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a need for some of it for people who do not have any self-esteem or anything, but the books on becoming assertive, you know, they go to the extreme.
That's it, That's when Ringer starts this one out. The very first sentence in the introduction to the book, he says, and I've memorized this almost verbatim, "You who have read my other book know that I must be perfectly honest with you right up front and tell you that the only reason I'm writing this book is to make as much money as I possibly can." Period. That's the first sentence in the introduction to the book. Tell it like it is, huh? Anything else about it? About this area?
I think one really important area that is prevalent today is physical fitness. I've worked with and dealt with lots of people very closely sometimes who sacrifice everything for physical fitness. They will spend 3 or 4 hours of prime time every day getting themselves physically fit.
Yeah.
You know, they think nothing of taking 6 or 8 hours on a weekend day to run an ultra marathon. In all of that, the only beneficiary to that is self. And it's a subtle one because there's this attractiveness of being physically fit, and the media, of course, pushes that to death right there.
Oh, yeah. Right. It's expensive, too. Okay, how about the other end, the other extreme, the extreme of self-sacrifice, and over here, over-caring, which is really caring that has gone awry. See, self-sacrifice is indeed a very noble goal. I mean, Jesus, lay down your life for your fellow human being. But this is the kind of stuff that is not self-sacrifice for the good of others. Most of the time, the subtlety of it is that the dynamic is very self-serving. And turns out that that many of the people who are over here on the self-sacrificing end actually shake out over on the self-serving end, but simply do not realize it. And many of the people around them do not realize it. And if some of the people around them do realize it and try to help them to some kind of insight, they become very offended and say, how dare you? The actuality of it is that it not only hurts the one who is sacrificing herself or himself, it, as I've suggested earlier, hurts the one who is ostensibly being helped by the self-sacrifice. The self-sacrificer behaves much more out of personal needs than out of altruism, which by definition is an unselfish devotion to the welfare of other people. We've become, fortunately, in the last decade, or maybe the last 15 years, much more aware of the potentially harmful effects of this kind of caring too much that Robin talks about in her book, Women Who Love Too Much. In the same category as false humility that we spoke of whenever I was talking with the group about self-image and how people get into false humility and how they get into putting themselves down because they believe that being proud of their achievements and having a positive self-esteem is somehow moving into the no person's land of arrogance, and God knows we don't want to do that as Christian people. And so we'll pretend that we're klutzes, and we will also put ourselves down and say, I am the lowest of the low, everyone comes before me, rather than affirming ourselves. And this pathological caring falls into essentially that same kind of category. And I'm suggesting that we've learned an awful lot about that over the last dozen or 15 years, largely through our understanding of the AA process and realizing that addiction is not limited to chemicals or drugs, but addiction literally turns out to be anything that will help us avoid the toughness of reality. And this, coming back to saying what I said earlier, this is especially an issue for us in the church because we are especially sensitive to becoming stuck on ourselves. That is the last thing that we want to do, we say. The last thing that I ever want to do is to become arrogant. And one of the things I mentioned, I think in the second session, we were talking about angelhood and devilry, persona and shadow. One of the dimensions of shadow manifests itself very clearly every time we say, the very last thing I would ever do is so-and-so. Anytime you catch yourself saying that, watch out, because you might just turn around and do it the next hour or the next day. Haven't you known people who have said, oh, I grew up in such a miserable, rotten home. A woman saying, the last kind of person I would ever marry would be one like my father. No, no. And she ends up marrying her father. Or vice versa.
A man says, oh, no, I would never, it's the exact opposite of my mother would be the kind of wife I want. And he ends up marrying a woman just like his mother. It's a very, very interesting phenomenon. It would be fun to explore that together. We wouldn't have time to do it right now. But trust me, anytime you find yourself with sort of the bile coming up and you're saying, I would never do that, watch out. Be careful. We've even learned some new words that I put up there on the board, the words codependent and enabling and burnout, which you mentioned. I tried to define these in the little book, Joy, here. And rather than dink around with them, I just want to read a couple sentences because they get kind of fuzzy and get kind of blended together. A codependent is a person who has developed an unhealthy pattern of relating to another person, usually, or others, plural, usually as a result of having been closely associated and involved with somebody who was dependent. The close association and involvement often causes the codependent to develop an overbearing personality. Secondly, a poor self-image. Thirdly, low self-esteem. And fourthly, a very strong need to be needed. And lastly, a deep wish to control and reshape the other person or persons. Now that sounds kind of harsh, but it's nevertheless accurate. In their need to be needed, codependents put themselves in positions of suffering for the sake of others, and find self-sacrifice to be their calling in life. Enabling refers to the behavior of someone who avoids intervening in the dependency or addiction of a person with whom they are closely associated. They fail to confront the dependent person with facts and consequences of his or her dependency. The terms dependency and addiction refer not only to alcohol and drugs, but to virtually anything that will allow a temporary avoidance of the pain of reality and an escape into a better, more comfortable experience. For instance, compulsive gambling, compulsive sexual activity, compulsive eating, compulsive dieting, working, cleaning, spending. The enabler, wishing not to offend or upset or criticize the dependent person, looks after and covers for him or her. Lies, actually, many times, for him or her. In overcaring, the enabler actually supports the other person's dependency. That's what I mean by contributing to the delinquency of a juvenile. The third word, burnout, has been called the disease of the overcommitted and the helper's occupational hazard. Burnout is a gradual physical, emotional, spiritual, and social breakdown as a result of a person's overextension in caring for others, along with a failure to take care of oneself. Well, I hate to read out of books, but I think that's the easiest way with something like this to make it very clear that we're dealing with some pretty heavy stuff. And heaven only knows how many of us are into these dimensions of overcaring without even realizing. I say sometimes it takes a true shock to come to our senses, so to speak, and realize that this is what is going on. Those are kind of hard words, but they're accurate in describing and defining the situation that we need to face if we're going to find some sense of balance in between these two extremes.